Welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CFBU 103.7 in St. Catharines. I'm your host, Daniel Angrenon, joined in studio today by Justin St. Ange, who's teching for me. On today's show, we'll be speaking with very good friend of the show, past host Carl Orzechowski, who is a filmmaker, musician. He's worked on Maximum Tolerated Dose, which is just being released on DVD, and will be participating in the Open the Cages tour with Lauren Corman, another host of the show, as well as Mike XVX, Jenny Bundock, and many more. And today we are going to be talking about the Calgary Stampede and rodeos. So the Calgary Stampede is entering its 101st year in Calgary right now and has been seen as especially controversial in light of the floods. This year's tagline is Come Hell or High Water, which is really kind of capitalized on the disaster. And it's an issue that definitely needs to be addressed cautiously, that we need to pay attention to, but focus on the animals, because that's really where our focus has been. Now, Carl has written a thesis in his master's about rodeo culture, and he's definitely been to many rodeos in southern Ontario and has developed a really cool insight into the culture, and I'm very pleased to have him on the show. So welcome to the show, Carl. I'm really happy to have you on.
Thanks so much, Dan. It's good to be on.
So maybe could we start by talking about your thesis and what your research entailed and what you were doing for it?
Sure. So my thesis took place from 2008 to 2010. It was part of my master's degree, or it was sort of the main project of my master's degree. Essentially, the thesis was sort of three parts. So it involved a deep cultural history of the rodeo in general. So that includes the history of rodeos in the U.S. and the proliferation of rodeos into Canada and across Canada. And then I looked at rodeo culture now, specifically looking at Southern Ontario, because that was the most opportune place for me to study it. And the rodeo also contained a photographic component. So in addition to attending a bunch of rodeos over the course of 2 years and interviewing cowboys and cowgirls about their experiences there, I also documented the rodeo and what happens to animals there through photography. So that was it in general, and it also included some stuff like film analysis of rodeo films, because I'm into film stuff, and it kind of took a bunch of things and kind of mashed them together into this rodeo business.
And it was a really, really interesting thesis to read, because it was so comprehensive. It really brought in all those aspects, and I think especially for me as a Calgarian, to read about the rodeo when I'm currently living in a place that's celebrating it so much was definitely very enlightening. To start off, for our listeners who maybe don't know too much about rodeos, could we talk about the history of the rodeo in Canada and what some of the events are?
Sure. So the history of the rodeo in Canada really is a history of the Calgary Stampede in a way. The Calgary Stampede was essentially the sort of first foray of rodeo into Canada, and that happened in the early 1900s. I believe it was around 1906 or 1916, one of those years. It was early in the 1900s, and rodeo had existed for a few decades actually already in the U.S. It started in the U.S. with a guy named Buffalo Bill Cody. And he would actually go around from town to town with a crew of animals and a crew of cowboys, and they would rustle up local cowboys to participate in these competitive events. Now, at the time, the events really had a lot to do with life on the ranch and on the farm. So they included things like calf roping, steer wrestling, things like that. I did find some debate as to whether these things were really related to agriculture. I think it is safe to say that a lot of the early rodeo events did have a basis in agricultural practice. It didn't really take long before that started to change. So the rodeo as it is now, and the events as they are now, they may have a distant root in some kind of agricultural practice that existed probably over 100 years ago, but they aren't really related to how agriculture is practiced now. You know, as a lot of the listeners of Animal Voices are probably aware, agriculture now looks very, very different from agriculture back in the 1800s. So the events that you'd find at rodeos now are things, basically they're divided into two different categories. So you have the timed events, which are events that are based around, you know, beating the clock. So you'll have barrel racing, you'll have calf roping, things like that. These are events where the competitors, they're racing against each other to compete a certain number of goals or a certain goal and to do it faster than the other people. The second category of events are probably the events that most people are more familiar with, and those are called the rough stock events. Rough stock events are essentially, you can think of them as the sort of bucking events. So that includes bronc riding and bull riding. And these are the events where, I mean, they also do have a time component. For example, in bull riding, the cowboy's goal is to stay on the bull for 8 seconds. That counts as a qualifying run. But essentially, those events contain much more struggle against the animal and the animal struggling against the human as well. And those are essentially the two kind of events that happen. The thing about the Calgary Stampede that sets it apart, the Calgary Stampede is the biggest rodeo in Canada by a huge margin. It's one of the biggest rodeos in the world. And one of the things that sets the Calgary Stampede apart from so many other rodeos in Canada and in the world is the chuck wagon race. So the chuck wagon race, if you can picture in your mind one of those canvas covered wagons from the kind of 1800s, 1700s, generally speaking, four horses or two horses in advance of them. That's what a chuck wagon race is. And you can picture probably about a half dozen or a dozen of those wagons just barreling along a circular track with horses in front of them. The chuck wagon race is the event that really sets the Calgary Stampede apart, not only in terms of its popularity, it's an extremely popular event, but it's also the event that probably has the highest number of animal fatalities every year. Pretty much every year, for as long as I can remember and for as long as I've done research, animals have died at the chuck wagon race, and I imagine that some will die this year as well.
Mm-hmm. I believe last year there was three that died. Since 1986, which is sort of when they started counting how many animals have been dying, there have been at least 50 that have died in the chuck wagon races. So yes, pretty much every year. I think there's something like 3 years since 1986 where there hasn't been a fatality. So just to talk about that rarity. So with that in mind, with all these deaths and the fact that the chuck wagons, as well as many of the other rodeo events, are very controversial events, there does seem to be a very intense loyalty when it comes to not just Calgarians, but I think in general, members of the rodeo culture towards the rodeo. There's sort of an idea that any critique, especially if it comes from an animal rights activist or someone who lives in the city, doesn't quite understand rural values or the intricacies of the rodeo as a very kind of rural-based sport. Would you be able to talk about your findings in your research in terms of that sort of insider-outsider and being brought into that rodeo culture?
Sure. So in my research, I looked at Southern Ontario as a case study. Between 2008 and 2010, I went to a couple of dozen rodeos across Southern Ontario, everywhere from the Royal Agricultural Fair Rodeo, which happens actually right in the middle of Toronto, to the sort of probably one of the smallest rodeos that I went to, which happened in a town that even most people who probably live within, you know, a driving or biking distance to it don't even know it's there. It's a little town called Milverton, Ontario. I went to lots of rodeos during that time and went there as a student, but also as a photographer and also as an interviewer, going there to speak with folks who participate in the rodeo about it. And to see for myself what rodeo is like. I don't think I ever really became an insider, despite the fact that, you know, I had a lot of nice moments while I was at the rodeos. I was treated well, and I was respected by virtue of the fact that I continually showed up, and I sort of didn't make a fool of myself. I was given a lot of access, and I was very much trusted with people's stories when I asked them questions. And I think I did get a certain amount of access that most people wouldn't normally have, just sort of showing up. And I was met with a great deal of skepticism at the beginning and throughout the sort of length of the project. And fair enough. I mean, from most of the people's perspective who are there, it's not that they, you know, I'm not trying to say something like, oh, they don't have a university education or blah, blah, blah. In fact, many of them do. But from their perspective, they exist in a context where they have a community. It's a set community. Most of the people who attend the rodeos know each other. All of the people who compete in the rodeos know each other quite well. They all hang out. This is their social network. So having someone new come in, especially someone who doesn't have, like, who literally has no connections within that social network, is a strange thing. And it took some time for people to warm up to me, but I think there was a certain amount of acceptance. So, you know, I think there is a rural-urban divide for sure. The rodeos take place in these tiny little towns where, I mean, most people haven't even heard of the towns that they take place in. And most people in Ontario honestly don't even know that rodeos happen here. We think of rodeos as, you know, something that might happen on the prairies. And we think of the Calgary Stampede because that's the only rodeo that really ever makes the news. But rodeos are a huge thing. They're certainly not mainstream, but they are a huge thing for rural communities. And when they happen, you'll see thousands of people in attendance. It's actually quite stunning to see, you know, to go to such a small town and be at an event where there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people. They're really important community events in that sense when a lot of people come together. The Calgary Stampede is, in terms of the sort of insider-outsider thing, is a bit of a different case. We've been sort of talking about the Calgary Stampede in a little bit of a collapsed way as sort of the same thing as rodeos in general. But the Calgary Stampede is kind of like World Series of rodeos. It's a massive, massive event with tens of thousands of people in attendance, maybe hundreds of thousands. And it's just a massive event. I mean, Calgary basically turns into Stampede Town during that time. And where a rodeo in a place like Milverton, Ontario may be set up by the local kind of, you know, the local Knights of Columbus or the local church group or whatever to act as a fundraiser for putting a new roof on the church or something like that. The Calgary Stampede is a huge tourist event that brings in millions and millions of dollars to the city of Calgary. So the insider-outsider politics don't quite apply in the same way in the sense of they want your money. The Calgary Stampede really is, it's an economic event. It doesn't exist on the same plane as other rodeos, and other rodeos don't exist on the same plane as the Calgary Stampede. The only thing that might intersect between the Calgary Stampede and other rodeos is that you might, in some cases, find some of the same competitors at these small-town rodeos actually make their way to competing in the Calgary Stampede. It really depends on whether they've qualified and that sort of thing. So I think I'm slowly getting around to answering your question.
No, that definitely covered it.
Covered it and probably some stuff you didn't you weren't asking about.
Elaboration is wonderful. Mm-hmm. Well, it's very interesting. I feel that living in Calgary, the Stampede has sort of appropriated the rural rodeo culture in the idea that it depends that city folks sort of blindly accept that as their own culture for 10 days. And it's very interesting in the way they sort of claim this culture. And I mean, just as you were saying, it does bring the money to the organizers. But it's interesting because in your thesis, you talk about how the rodeo folk would say something like, before you judge the rodeo, come check it out. And then after you went and checked it out and your opinion didn't really change, you know, they told you, well, you just don't understand. And so it's very interesting because I think what we do in Calgary depend on the fact that Calgarians themselves don't really understand that culture either. But the fact that they still benefit from the exploitation of animals, they aren't as quick to criticize Calgarians as they would, say, Calgarian animal rights activists.
Right. Well, I mean, I should clarify too, I was never told, well, I just don't get it. That was definitely the sense that I got sort of as I wrapped up the project, mostly because I think the idea and the rhetoric that I had a lot of cowboys say to me, I would ask them, what do you say to people who criticize rodeo? And what would you say to someone who criticizes rodeo on the basis that it's cruel or whatever? And really, the most common response was, I encourage people to come down and see it for themselves and then to decide. And there's a few things to unpack in that question. So the first thing is that I think it actually is a genuine sort of offer. And I feel like I'm kind of proof of that. I paid admission to go to rodeos, but I was also accepted into other events. I went to a weekend bull riding clinic where they teach young teenagers and older teenagers how to ride junior steers and full-size bulls. These are not public events. These were events that are sort of put on within the culture itself, where people learn the ropes of how to do the events. And I was allowed to go to those things because I think there was a genuine desire, at least on the part of some people, to show me around and to let me experience things and see what it was like. On the other hand, there were also people who made my time attending rodeos extremely uncomfortable, and who really didn't appreciate me being there and didn't exactly roll out the red carpet for the master's student from Toronto, which is fine. I didn't expect any special treatment, but it was a bit here and there. So the idea that, you know, come on down and see it for yourself, that's one aspect, is that I do think that was genuine for the most part. The second aspect is, as city folk, if we go down and see it for ourselves, do we really understand what's happening anyway? It reminds me of the book by Erica Fudge. I believe it's just called Animal. And she talks about the famous image of Ham, who was the space chimp who was sent up into space and was, I think, the first chimp to go up and to successfully come back down alive. There's a famous photo of him where he's where it appears that he's smiling and he's reaching for an apple. You know, he's just come back, and the first thing that he's sort of sees when he gets unhatched is this person holding an apple, and he appears to be smiling, but in fact, the bearing of the teeth is actually a sign of fear in chimpanzees and a sign of aggression. And so we're in this position where if we go to the rodeo, do we really understand what we're seeing? And it's also, I think it's a valid question to pose to rodeo folks as well. Do they understand what they're seeing when they see a horse bucking? Do they see an animal who is excited? Do they see an animal who is an aggressive animal? Or do they see an animal who is in pain or in fear? The words we use to describe these different things are kind of subjective words, but there is an underlying reality that everyone is trying to sort of understand, or ostensibly everyone's trying to understand. So if you, for example, Dan, did go, I don't know, have you ever attended any rodeos, like actually gone in and seen the events and been at the rodeo yourself, maybe when you were younger or anything?
Yes, when I was a kid, I went a few years before I knew.
Right. And so what was it like? Like, what did you think about what was, do you remember much about it? Were you like really, really young?
I was fairly young. What I do remember, it was a lot like watching a sport, you know, and you cheered along with who you're supposed to cheer along with. And they didn't really focus on the animals. They focused a lot on the riders, and the animals were sort of like the equipment of the sport. And that's sort of what I recall. It's been a very long time since then.
Yeah. So, I think for people who attend the rodeos, there's all kinds of layers of obstruction of what happens to animals and how the animals are actually feeling about what's going on. The idea that you can come on down to the rodeo and see it for yourself and all of a sudden have a clear picture of what's happening, I mean, I think the intention behind a statement like that might be genuine, but it's kind of like saying, come on down to the magic show and see what we're, you know, it doesn't, when you actually talk about asking people in the stands to go see what's going on, there's so many things happening. There's music, there's an announcer who's setting the rhetoric of what's going on. The animals are, you know, separated by large pieces of equipment that make it difficult to see what's happening at different times. And at different really important times when things are happening to the animals, they're sort of priming them for the events. So, yeah, it's a difficult question to broach, this sort of idea that if you go down, you can just all of a sudden understand it.
I think you have some really interesting points, and they lead really well into my next question. We don't really have a common, accepted, clear term of what is animal cruelty, you know, especially in terms of what an animal rights activist would see versus what a cowboy would see of the exact same situation. For instance, trying to taunt a bull into bucking, right? Whereas the cowboys might see it as part of the event, we might see it as violence. Would you be able to maybe elaborate more? Like, is this a question of moral universality versus cultural relativity, or what are your thoughts?
One of the things that I always struggle with in terms of discussing sort of animal practices in an objective sense versus interjecting my own opinion is trying to balance the sort of what I think you're aptly calling cultural relativism versus a kind of, I mean, I do believe that there is a truth that everyone is trying to get at, or maybe only animal rights activists are trying to get at. But that being said, you know, if we look at the rodeo as a culture and we look at the people who participate in it, and then we look at people who are opposed to it, who stand on the outside, my goal with the thesis was to understand the different truths that are at play and to understand how those things sort of push and pull against each other, setting aside my own version of the truth, which is that I think that rodeos are incredibly stressful and cruel events for animals. And I mean, I've been a part of rodeo protests. I've seen, you know, I was able, because of the access that I had, to actually see rodeo events much more closely than most people who are spectators. So I was given an access that was really remarkable and allowed me to really get up close to it. And, you know, it really didn't change my opinion. I didn't walk away from it saying, you know what, you know, I think they do care about those animals. I think they care by their definition of care. You know, rodeos happen in a context of, you know, most people who participate in them come from an agricultural background. You will find the occasional kind of what some of them call weekend warriors, you know, people who are from the city who go to participate in rodeos on the weekends. But generally speaking, most of the people who participate in rodeos are people who come from rural areas. They participate in farming, whether it's sort of more local small-scale farming or larger factory farming. And to them, their definition of animal care is very different from what an animal rights activist definition of animal care is. So it can be difficult at times to parse a lot of this stuff because we use the same words for very, very different meanings. And I think that's kind of getting at what you're saying. But again, I'm not trying to sort of give rodeo culture a pass. If anything, I think in my thesis, I give a fair deal of criticism to all the stuff that happens there. But that being said, my goal with the thesis was to really try and understand what makes rodeo culture tick and to see how it's sort of developed over time so we can get a better sense of how we can work against it and help the animals there.
Would we be able to talk about what happens to the animals before the rodeo and after the rodeo itself?
Sure. So rodeo animals come from farms. they are agricultural animals, and they're provided to rodeos through people who are titled stock contractors. So a stock contractor's job is pretty much exactly what it sounds like. They are the people who you contract the stock from for the events. So you have a lot of different kinds of animals at the rodeo. You have junior bulls, you have full-size bulls, you have bucking horses, you have racing horses. You have smaller calves that are used for calf roping. You might have sheep that are used in youth events called mutton busting. There's a wide range of animals, and the stock contractor essentially is in charge of providing all those animals from there. So the animals essentially come from local farms and farms that the stock contractor is connected with. They're more or less rented for a period of the rodeo. The only exception to this would be in the barrel racing and other mounted events where people are riding horses. In those cases, generally speaking, the horses, quote unquote, belong to the people who are riding them. In those cases, it's really, as far as the sport goes, more advantageous for those people to use horses that they're more familiar with. So those horses would come from those private farms, I suppose. And that's essentially where the animals come from and how they get there.
I think it's interesting, in your thesis, one of the arguments that some of the cowboys said was that if these animals didn't go to the rodeo, they would wind up as veal anyways. Would you be able to maybe talk more about sort of how that industry plays in with the rodeo?
Right. So the veal industry is not necessarily connected to rodeos any more so than any other animal exploitation, you know, sort of beef or dairy or anything like that is connected to the rodeo. I had a couple of cowboys during interviews, you know, say to me, this is a good thing. It gives these animals a job. And it's a really, I don't know, it's a kind of funny turn of phrase for kind of a sad reality, is that these animals exist in a context and the rodeo exists in a larger context of animal exploitation. When we talk about rodeo culture, what we're really talking about is rural culture, and it's really not that different from mainstream city culture as well when it comes to how we look at animals. One of the things that was actually quite sort of remarkable to me that really made the rural and urban divide feel very, very small for me was seeing how a lot of the rodeo folk interacted with their companion animals. So a lot of people who are on the rodeo circuit and a few really key folks on the circuit were really, really proud of their companion animals. One of the rodeo clowns that I interviewed actually even had breeding dogs and chihuahuas, and he had, you know, a little litter of six chihuahuas in his trailer, and he was really, really fond of them. And, you know, these particular animals had a very special place in his heart. I mean, he was breeding them, so that's not to say that they weren't part of a process of exploitation themselves, but, you know, they held a special place in his heart that I think the other rodeo animals didn't necessarily. Now, again, when we talk about, when we use words like care or animal welfare or cruelty, our definition of these words are very different from what rodeo culture's definition of those words would be.
In Calgary, for instance, the Calgary Stampede, a lot of the horses that don't make the cut, you know, they're trained to race and stuff, but the ones that don't make it go to horse slaughterhouses. And there's some by Fort McLeod, I think. So I think there's some in Alberta and there's some in Quebec. And it just kind of shows how perhaps their point isn't to kill the horse, but the industry is still so like intricately tied. And I mean, my question to you, I guess, is after the rodeo, say, you know, a bull or a steer or whatever, do they wind up in the slaughterhouse as well anyways? Or a horse, I guess?
Again, horses are a bit of a special case because in some cases they may have a personal relationship with the person who uses them at multiple events, whereas the bucking bulls and the bucking horses and, you know, the calves that are used in roping events. They do get names because it's kind of sexy to give a big bucking bull a name like Killer or something like that. It makes the event seem a bit more exciting, but for all intents and purposes, these are essentially anonymous animals. They come from the stock contractor. When the events are over, they may be used at another rodeo or they may not be. They may go back to the farm where they're from. And essentially, they're sort of rented out from their sort of typical exploitation, and they're brought to the rodeo for kind of a special weekend of a different kind of exploitation, and then they're taken back. So it's, yeah, despite the kind of humor that we might find in a phrase like, you know, being in the rodeo gives these animals a job, it doesn't actually give them a special purpose and a special treatment. If anything, it actually sort of removes them from their typical routine and puts them in this even more confusing context where they're in a place that often has thousands of people, loud music, huge audience, strange equipment and strange areas that sort of funnel them in and out of the events. And yeah, I don't think it actually necessarily makes their lives any better. If anything, I think it makes them worse. And and the animals they don't go to a rodeo retirement home. They go to the same slaughterhouse that all the other animals go to.
One thing I was kind of curious about to ask you was, I've sort of found conflicting information when it comes to my own research or, you know, asking around about it. In terms of, I guess, the bulls specifically, the rodeo itself interprets them as both like this villain who's trying to buck off the cowboy, as well as sort of a beloved and cared for, you know, domesticated animal, but they're also, you know, obviously an object. But one thing in terms of the training, I've heard from a lot of places that bulls and cows are naturally sort of docile, and obviously the flank strap is used in order to get them to get angry to buck. But on the other hand, I hear stuff like they're semi-tamed and they're bred in order to have like very aggressive traits. I was just wondering what you've sort of found is true or seems to be the case in your experience with seeing these bulls.
Essentially, my information as far as it pertains to that stuff in particular, is very much by word of mouth. There's not a lot of published information that you might find about this sort of thing and about the sort of breeding lines and how they do it and that sort of thing. This is where the place of the stock contractor is actually quite important, and different rodeos and rodeo companies are very loyal to certain stock contractors who provide them with what they believe are the quote-unquote best quality animals for their different events. Now, when it comes to bulls in particular, what I heard when I was on the rodeo circuit was very similar to what you're saying, that bulls are bred, and it's clear that some bulls are, you know, if we could call them more aggressive than others, but it's really just how they react to how they're handled. So yeah, while you may have a particular bull who might be much more aggressive with the cowboys, I didn't really see any of the bulls who on their own were aggressive. When they're sort of back in the pen just amongst themselves, they are all quite docile and they kind of just act like cows, you know? And cows are really not the most aggressive animals, and neither are bulls, really. They're dangerous by virtue of their size and their horns and that sort of thing, but they're really generally not too aggressive. Once they get into the chutes, though, and once they start being prodded or spurred on or different things like that, then, and then there's loud music playing and you know, the context changes, and all of a sudden you can see an animal who's quite docile and, you know, who you'd want to just go up and pet and talk to. You see that animal transform into an individual who is acting under really extreme and kind of confusing stress. And yeah, it's, you know, there's that saying of like studying people in a prison doesn't tell you about people, it tells you about what people in a prison are like. And looking at an animal in the at the rodeo doesn't necessarily tell you what that animal is like, it just tells you how they react to that particular situation.
Now, I'm hoping to kind of change the focus a little now. One of the topics you mentioned in your thesis, both in terms of the rodeo culture in general, as well as some of the films you studied, was there's definitely attached to rodeo culture is a culture of masculinity and machismo. It relates to both the dominance of animals as well as women. I was wondering if you can maybe elaborate on that a bit more for our listeners.
The rodeos that I attended were really interesting in the sense that there is definitely a certain machismo, and there's a machismo on display of, you know, the cowboy as a sort of celebrated figure within that context. But in some ways, it wasn't as sharp as I kind of expected it to be. A lot of the events, I would say about a third or maybe even close to half of the events in the rodeo involve women, and women clearly play a really prominent supporting role, as women in a patriarchal culture are often forced to do. There is definitely, in the history of rodeo and in the culture that surrounds rodeo, not just when I say the culture that surrounds it, I don't just mean, you know, what I witnessed or that sort of thing. I mean, you know, everything from movies to the imagery to how outsiders perceive it. It's very much focused, yeah, around a sort of really profound sense of a very particular kind of masculinity, where in our culture we have these sort of icons of like the Marlboro Man and, you know, Clint Eastwood as Blondie and these other kind of really prominent figures in our cultural mythology that tell us that, you know, the cowboy is kind of like the ultra man. and so, you know, at the rodeo, I did see that sort of stuff manifest itself a little bit. I would actually say that it probably manifested itself more in the younger generation than it did in the older generation. I think mostly because the younger kids are probably a bit more wrapped up in all that mythology stuff, whereas the adults have had a bit more sort of, maybe we can call it real life time, where they can't just exist in this macho world where they can kind of flaunt their masculinity so openly and kind of expect to be dealt with in that way. But when you saw some of the younger teenage boys, or the kind of 16, 17-year-old teenage boys, it was the machismo and the kind of overt masculinity was much more open. I'm not sure if that exactly answers your question, but...
Oh, definitely. And I think going from there, one of the things that was talked about was sort of the compartmentalization of women's roles in the rodeo. And it sort of fits in with my next question. It seems that there's definitely a financial structure in the rodeo, in terms of, obviously, the animals are unpaid labor and they benefit those who are maybe higher on the pyramid. And then on top of that is, you know, the owners of the rodeo or the sponsors, or in the Calgary Stampede, you know, there's huge sponsors and the huge money-making opportunities. Would you be able to maybe explain that a little further for our listeners?
So I think actually the economic structure of rodeos, I can't speak exactly to the structure of the Stampede. I assume that Calgary Stampede, you know, trademark, copyright, blah, 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 is actually its own corporation that, you know, handles all the revenue. And I'm sure it's a for-profit corporation. It's not a charity. The rodeos that happen around Southern Ontario and a lot of the sort of smaller rodeos that happen around North America, they work a little something like this. So you'll have a rodeo company. Now, in Ontario, there are two rodeo companies that sort of make their way around Ontario over the course of the season. Those rodeo companies are going to go from town to town, and they're essentially paid by local groups to come and put on the show. So the rodeo company makes a certain amount of money per event. You know, the rodeo company might get a flat rate plus a percentage, but the sort of local group that's putting it on often uses the rodeo as like a fundraiser for some local community thing. So that's kind of how the sort of economics of how the rodeo gets to town works. As far as within the rodeo itself, the people who participate in it and so on, That's a bit more interesting, I think, because this is actually where I found a lot in common with rodeo folk, in the sense that a lot of the people who participate in the rodeos, the folks who go from city to city, who pack up in their truck and they go from one event to another, these are folks who make virtually nothing from the rodeo. They may make enough to put gas in the tank and to get food for the next week. Many of them hold down full-time jobs over the course of the week so that they can do the rodeo events on the weekends. And they are essentially, you know, similar to, as I've done many, many times, they go on tour and they follow the rodeo on tour to do their thing. As the announcers often remind you when you're at the rodeo, in any given event, if the person doesn't place in the top three, all they get is your applause. And so every participant in the rodeo has to pay a fee to get in. There's no free entry. So every participant pays a fee, and if they get in the top three in their event, which is actually a lot more difficult than it sounds, they may get a little bit of prize money. And that prize money may or may not be enough to sort of sustain them. It's definitely not enough to sustain them as human beings, but it may be enough to sustain them if they're just touring from town to town. And the rodeo company kind of parses out that money based on, you know, the fee that they might take from the local group to actually bring the rodeo there. You know, the rodeo company will be the company that pays the stock contractor. So it's a somewhat complicated web of relationships, of economic relationships that make the rodeo happen. But as you said, it's all based upon, you know, the biggest source of free labor in the rodeo, which is the animals themselves. You know, the stock contractor has to pay to get them from local farms, or has to, if he's bringing his own animals, you know, feed them and house them and that sort of thing. But they are essentially completely unpaid, completely exploited labor. And they are the sort of bottom of the pyramid that makes the rest of the pyramid possible. If animals weren't exploited for their labor and for their time, the rodeo just wouldn't happen.
I think in response to that, when it comes to the Calgary Stampede, it happens on a bit of a higher level as to what you're saying. For example, with the chuck wagon races, I know that there's usually auctions that go into the thousands in order to get a company's name and logo on the side of a chuck wagon as it runs around. And the product placement is very much integrated into the nature of the race. So it's just kind of interesting how, I guess, it's like the small town rodeo style, but, you know, super injected with these capitalist values and with all the money that a city may have to offer.
You'd be surprised. The smaller town rodeos are not that different, in the sense that there's tons of advertising and there's tons of sponsorship that happens. There's, you know, the barrels in the rodeo arena are covered in vodka advertising, and there's, in the same way that you'd see the boards around the, you know, like a hockey game or an NHL game, there's sort of a similar thing that sort of rings around the rodeo arena. There's plenty of advertising on the smaller scale as well. You might be talking about smaller advertising rates, but the advertising is still there, and the sponsors are still there. And I mean, the small town values are capitalist values. They're not capitalist in the same sort of crushing kind of really overt way, but they are. And the way that the rodeo is structured, you know, it really is a capitalist venture, and the way that animals are exploited, the way that the sort of people on the bottom of the chain are exploited to a degree, it all fits in with that capitalist framework.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're getting pretty close to the end of the interview, but I had two more questions for you. One of the main themes of your thesis was connecting the rodeo to sort of a sense of nationalism, or I guess sort of a small town nationalism. And I think we definitely see that in Calgary. It's almost as if there's a tautology where the Stampede is Calgarian because it claims to be Calgarian identity. Like it's a cyclical line of reasoning there. And I was just wondering what sort of were your findings in terms of how the rodeo fits in with a Canadian nationalist identity, or doesn't?
So the way that I looked at nationalism in my thesis, and it was actually similar to how I looked at in my undergrad thesis, I looked at nationalism as it relates to the seal hunt. And I always see nationalism as sort of multifaceted and existing on different scales. So we have the sort of the idea of Canadian nationalism, and in the Stampede, you'll see it very overtly. I mean, it looks like a Canadian flag sale at times. But even at the smaller scale, at the rural rodeos, you'll see a lot of sort of Canadian iconography and imagery. In my photographic exploration of rodeo culture in Ontario, I documented so many instances of just, you know, very overt and more subtle forms of nationalism that work their way into the rodeo. This can be everything from there's a group of cowgirls who call themselves the Canadian Cowgirls, and they come out and they are all wearing these matching red and white outfits, and they have flags that they carry with them, and they sing the national anthem, and it's very nationalistic. But then there's also sort of, the singing of the national anthem, while it's very common at sporting events, the way that it's framed in rodeo culture is very specific. So there's that kind of, maybe we can call it like a macro nationalism or like a Canadian nationalism. But then there's also the nationalism on the level of what we've been talking about before, which is the kind of insider-outsider politics. So as opposed to thinking of the rodeo as existing in Canada, we can think of rodeo nationalism and the rodeo nation as existing within a sort of smaller scale within the country. So there are like pockets of the rodeo nation within this larger nation that we call Canada. And you'll know that you're in the rodeo nation when you attend a rodeo in a place where you've never been to before, that's very far away from the cities that you may frequent, or even the smaller towns that you may frequent. And the rodeo nation is, again, when I talk about rodeo culture, I'm talking about the rodeo nation. Those words are somewhat interchangeable. But the way that I always use a particular theorist's definition of language, his name's Benedict Anderson, and he talks about this idea of imagined communities. A lot of the folks in a given, say, small town who put on a rodeo will know each other, but a lot of them won't. But they're sort of brought together through this idea that this animal practice that they participate in, this sort of form of animal exploitation, unites them. And this is something that's really, really common. You know, we see it in the Canadian seal hunt. We see it in bullfighting in Spain. We see it in whaling in Japan. All around the world, both in terms of certain countries and certain regions within countries, the way that a particular group of people interacts with and exploits or chooses not to exploit certain animals is a way of defining themselves and a way of setting themselves apart and a way of knowing who's in and who's out. So when I talk about nationalism as it pertains to the rodeo nation, that's kind of what I'm getting at, that this set of animal practices is something that is important for the people who participate in it, and it's part of the way that they define themselves.
Mm, that's really such a great point. We are really, really almost out of time, but I really want to ask this last question. So, you know, if you can try to answer it as concisely as possible, I was wondering, do you think it's possible to develop an alternative rodeo culture that doesn't exploit animals? So I know personally, when I go to these demos, like, I'm okay with the stampede happening, but I'd like the rodeo and the chuck wagons to stop, right? What's your opinion?
You know, the rodeo in and of itself is based around animal exploitation. Kind of like saying, can you imagine bullfights without the bulls? No, I can't really imagine an alternative rodeo culture that doesn't involve exploiting animals. Maybe I'm being unimaginative. you know, the thing about a lot of the rodeos that I went to is that in a lot of ways, they're not very different from like county fairs or, county exhibitions, as I think we talked about before. You know, they're these kind of rural events that a lot of the locals come out to and enjoy. But I think in a lot of ways, the animal component really doesn't need to be there. It's there now, but I think that communities, regardless of this kind of spectacle of animal exploitation, communities find ways to come together and celebrate and be with each other without, we can do that without having this sort of spectacle of animal exploitation be a part of it.
That's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much, Carl, for coming back on the show. I know we definitely love to have you here on Animal Voices.
No problem. Thanks for having me, Dan.
Yeah, no problem. Now, if you want to learn more about the Calgary Stampede or possibly want to get involved, organize against it if you are a Calgarian, you can look up the Calgary Animal Rights Effort on Facebook. Thank you very much to Justin St. Ange for teching today's show. Thanks once again to Carl for coming on and being my guest today. It was really an amazing interview about the rodeo, and it was great to talk about the Calgary Stampede because it's such a topical issue this time. Animal Voices is hosted and produced at CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto and CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines. Thank you to our whole team, Lauren Corman, Neil Harvey, Aaron O'Sullivan, Taylor Book, and Kevin Tillman. You can always contact us at animalvoices@gmail.com or find us on our Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr pages. I'm Daniel Angernon. Thanks very much for listening.